Good morning, Mr. President.
How are you, my friend?
Good. I'm sorry about the phone being off the hook upstairs. Everybody running around there trying to fix it. The upstairs phone just said somebody left it.
That indicates you got some children in the house.
No.
Well, that every phone's off the hook at my place when I got that 16-month grandson.
Yeah,
he's a mechanic. He works on it all the time.
He's an inquiry. He got an inquiring mind. Goes into things. See what it's all about.
Well, I've got one this morning that's pretty rough for you. We have found that our friend, Republican nominee, our California friend, has been playing on the outskirts with our enemies and our friends both, our allies and the others. He's been doing it through rather subterranean sources here. And he has been saying to the allies that you're going to get sold out. Watch Yalta and Potsdam and two Berlins and everything. And they're going to recognize NLF, and I don't have to do that. You better not give away your liberty just a few hours before I can preserve it for you. One or two of his business friends divulged it first a couple of days ago about the time he made the statement that he had rumors that the staff was selling out, but he did not include me in it. You saw that, didn't you?
Yeah, but he sort of retracted that, didn't he?
Well, no. Laird put that out, traveling with him. They have three planes, and he's on a separate plane, and his job is to spread rumors and background the press. They all like him because he's strong for health and education and welfare on that HEW committee. And so the press likes him, and he puts that out. Nixon comes along and says, now, I have heard this, but I do not believe it. In other words, I do not believe Laird. I believe the president is not crooked. They say he is, but I don't believe he is. And he becomes a very strong defender of the president. The press resents it. They come back and say, well, hell, if you don't believe it, why did your man put it out? The man wrote the story. He's very reliable, Merriman Smith. He's covered the White House under four or five presidents. But that is what happened. The next thing that we got our teeth in was one of his associates, a fellow named Mitchell, who is running his campaign, who's real Sherman Adams of the operation. In effect, said to a businessman that we're going to handle this like we handle the Fortas matter, unquote. We're going to frustrate the president by saying to the South Vietnamese and the Koreans and the Thailanders, beware of Johnson. At the same time, we're going to say to Hanoi, I can make a better deal than he has because I'm fresh and new, and I don't have to demand as much as he does in the light of past position. Now, when we got that pure by accident as a result of some of our Wall Street connection, that caused me to look a little deeper.
I guess so.
And I have means of doing that, as you may well imagine.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Chenault is contacting their ambassador from time to time. Seems to be kind of the go-between, the Chiang Kai-shek deal. In addition, their ambassador is saying to them that Johnson is desperate and is just moving heaven and earth to elect Humphrey. So don't you get sucked in on that. He is these folks' agents here. This little South Vietnamese ambassador. Now, this is not guesswork.
Well, I didn't understand exactly how Taiwan got in it.
Well, Mrs. Chenault,
I didn't understand just what Chiang had to do with it.
Well, I don't know that he has anything except just generally that lobby. It may be Walter Judd. I know it's her. Mrs. Chenault, of the Flying Tigers. She's young and attractive. I mean, she's a pretty good-looking girl. And she's around town, And she is warning them not get pulled in on this Johnson move. Then he, in turn, is warning his government. Then we, in turn, know pretty well what he's saying out there. So he is saying that, well, that he's got to play it for time and get it by the next few days. Now, the Soviets are climbing the wall, and Hanoi is, and of course our people in Paris are, because they have agreed that they will let the GVN come to the table. That has been the thing we've insisted on. They have met our demand. The Soviets have said that they understand that we're going to resume if they violate the DMZ, and we can see that immediately after we make the announcement whether they are or not. We have reserved the right for reconnaissance, and we've made it clear that it's act of force and not act of war in our announcement. And we got South Vietnam and all the Allies aboard on a one day. We'd announce it one day and meet the next. But Hanoi wanted more time, so they demanded a couple of weeks, and then 10 days, and then a week, and we wouldn't do it because we thought that Saigon couldn't stand to wait that long between the time of the announcement and the time of the meeting. So we insisted on one day because Hanoi had said that productive discussions could begin the next day. So we took them at their word. About that time, Humphrey made a fool speech in which he said that he would stop the bombing without a comma or semicolon. He'd just make it period. Well, it did for 10 days, and then Bundy made a fool speech, and they had to all of them dissect that and take it to take. Yes, but it's the Adlai Stevenson group, and they just get the tail over the dashboard right at the right time. They do the wrong thing every time, but we wore that out, and we got it back on the track. And in getting it back on the track, meantime, Nixon gets scared to death, so he gets into the thing. And it gets off the track at the other place. Now, everybody had approved the one-day thing. Then they came along and approved the three-day thing, and they actually got down to the wording of the announcement, a joint announcement to be made by the two of us. And it was all agreed upon, all satisfactory. Then Nixon gets on, says, I know you're selling out now, just wait a few days. And you can't trust Johnson may want to, really, he's gonna pet the North Vietnamese NLF on the back, just like Roosevelt did the Russians. And that scares him. So then they come back. He gets it through their ambassador here. And they think that he's just been mad that something's going to happen this election. He's just not erratic at all. Now I've played no politics with him and not going to, and I've given Humphrey more hell in their joint meetings than I have Nixon. Nixon's been pretty responsible. But I don't want to pass up an opportunity and just sit here on my fanny till he comes in and let him just pick up like Eisenhower did the Korean thing and say, well, I did so-and-so. Same time, I don't want another day to go that I don't have to when I get what I've asked for. Now, the situation I'm in now is the effect of letting Chu say, well, we got to have more time. First, he says, we haven't got enough time to get a delegation there. Second, this Key gets in it, and Key says that he thinks that we're really winning militarily and just give a few more days and we'll have everything. And then the Key demands that rather than have a coup, that he be the advisor in Paris. And we've got all those things. Now, we have put off and put off and put off, and we are trying to bring them aboard after we had them aboard on both times. They were all firm. Now Abrams came in before I'd finally make up my mind, and he spent several hours with me, just he and I. And then he met with the group. But he not only recommends, he urges me to take this action with or without them. That we cannot do any good in the North for the next 90 days anyway. That we need this power in South Vietnam, and we need this power in Laos. And in any event, the guarantees that we get on the DMZ, if they carry them out all right, if they don't, we're not bound. But what we would get at the DMZ, which will be reflected in 2 hours after we make the announcement, what we would get there and what we'd get by immunity from the cities would permit him to go through the countryside, and with the psychological advantage of having these fools at the parish meeting, kind of wrap up the country. And he says, from a strictly military standpoint, that this military power is no good for 90 days on account of your weather. That it is needed and will be used. Now, you either get something for it or you don't, because he's going to use it anyway. 90% of it in Laos and South Vietnam, even if I didn't issue an order here, he would do it there, because he says it's unlikely that you'll get more than 1 or 2 days a month that you can do anything.
Well, they've been giving out a whole lot of reports I couldn't understand, but I saw they hit a truck and all that.
Well, they've had 10 days, and we're coming to the end of that last 10 days.
I see.
And by the time we put the thing in to have the meeting, why, there won't be much chance. In any event, he says this thing has changed so radically since last August that not only do we no longer endanger our men, that this gives them much more protection than they'd have if we just followed the existing policy. Now, I've heard all that, and I've seen all that in cables, but I just didn't take it. I made him come in. And he is much stronger than even any of your joint chiefs. His general statement was very much along the line of McConnell's, if you remember it.
Yes, I do quite well.
So we thought that it was all gone already. Then at noon yesterday, Chu comes in and says, no. And now the question is, do you leave him in Korea and Thailand, or they'll all hang together? They're scared to death, these people. So forth. So we've tried to get them back on board. We don't think they're going to come in the light of the Nixon thing. We did.
Nixon, I never did have any comms with him, but damn if I thought he'd shoot anything like that.
Well, it may be his agents. All we know is I saw him on television this morning in Syracuse last night. And he says that this conference must be broadened to include the Soviet. Well, we are talking to them every day, two or three times a day.
He, I doubt they really want to be in it.
They wouldn't be in it. They wouldn't come to it. And he just makes an ass of himself. They have to act. They are scared to death of the Chinese, and everything they do is subterranean. But there's no question what they're in it. I made him Sunday night go back to Kosygin and say that he understood that I was doing this on his... for his full knowledge and the problem I would have on DMZ and the cities, and he better understand that and not charge me with deceit, because if they didn't abide by it, I was going to hit them. And he came back and said that my doubts about their abiding by it were not justified. So he is in it, but Nixon says that the Soviet ought to be brought in, and he says other Asian countries must come to the conference. Well, a few hours later, this was last night, but this morning at 9 o'clock, we get a wire from Korea saying they ought to be in the conference. So he's kind of playing with the Asians, you see, to divide us, and they're trying to do what the Hanoi has been unable to do for 5 years. Divide me from Korea and Thailand and so forth, and that's this damned election. Therefore, what I think seriously I will do is this. The South Vietnamese have no good reason for not coming. They say they need more time. So I think instead of saying that we...
2-3 months. I don't know what they do at the time.
Well, they say they got to get a delegation, all that. I think I'll say to them, well, I'll give you the next meeting we'll have now, normally comes up Wednesday. We had one today. That gives you a full week. Now, they said 3 or 4 days ago that they'd need a week, 10 days, 2 weeks. Well, we'll give you a full week. Now, we're going to stop in the next few hours. And we're going